Well, I've been looking forward to today for many, many reasons. Talking to Ladysmith Black Mambazo was really cool. So how do you top that? Well, you have one of my favorite artists on the show, and that's James Gurney. He is not only one of my favorite artists, but he's also one of our favorite guests. He's best known for his illustrated book series, Dinotopia. He specializes in painting realistic images of scenes that can't be photographed, from dinosaurs to ancient civilizations, and he has a lot going on right now. His new art instruction video is Watercolor in the Wild, plus Dinotopia, the fantastical art of James Gurney, is an exhibition of original oil paintings from the New York Times bestselling Dinotopia series. That'll be opening on Valentine's Day at the Stanford Museum and Nature Center in Stanford, Connecticut. And it is a great pleasure to have James Gurney in our studio this morning. Always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Joe.
I'll tell you, time flies, because I was realizing that it had actually been almost 3 years since you were last here, which I find stunning. So I've missed you, and it's very nice to have you back. Before we talk about the video, let's talk a little bit about the Dinotopia show. This is a show that originated at the Norman Rockwell Museum and has been traveling for quite some time now.
Yes, it's been in Canajoharie, it's been in Florida, it's been at the Delaware Art Museum, and this time it'll be coming to the Stanford Museum and Nature Center. And it's about 50 paintings, a few more than 50, original paintings from the illustrated fantasy books Dinotopia and their sequels that I did. Also, some of the preliminary sketches and the models or maquettes that I used for reference. And they even have some dinosaur fossils in their collection there. So they're able to have some Connecticut Valley footprints, dinosaur footprints, and some dinosaur bones there as well.
What I know we've talked about this before, but I find this always an interesting subject, and that is, what is it about us, what is it especially about kids, that identify so much, do you think, with dinosaurs?
Well, for me, what always fascinated me since I was a kid, but even more so as an adult, was the fact that they were real, and we can see the evidence of their existence in footprints and fossils, but we have to imagine what they look like.
Right.
And how we imagine them has been changing as the science has been changing. Even in the last few years, since the last Dinotopia book came out in 2007, there have been a lot of amazing discoveries of feathered dinosaurs in China. And that means, for an artist like me, that means I have to think differently about how you paint even a tyrannosaur, which used to be the big scaly creature, but now we have to think of the tyrannosaurs and their kin as more like birds, more feathery, more fuzzy looking.
So when you look at your previous work, and the first Dinotopia book came out
1992.
So when you look at that early work, do you see it as perhaps being not as factual as it was when you first did it?
Well, yes, in a way, because the evidence takes you only so far. And
right.
the part about dinosaurs that really interests me the most is not only their physical appearance and whether they're covered with feathers or not, but also their behavior, things that we may not ever know about, what their sleeping postures were like and how they drank water and how they scratched themselves and the courtship displays. When I do scientific illustrations for Scientific American or National Geographic, I'm working with scientists to try to see what do we really know, what can we speculate about, and then what kind of parallels we can draw from the natural world by looking at birds and reptiles.
But the word fantastical, I mean, it gives you a sense of a fantasy as well. There is certainly that quality to that Dinotopia work.
Yes, with Dinotopia, we're starting with a fantasy premise of here's this one island where dinosaurs never went extinct and where humans formed a civilization over the centuries. And it's all told from the point of view of an explorer, Arthur Dennison, who comes there in the 19th century, along with his son, Will. And we follow their adventures as they explore this world. They meet the dinosaurs. They go to these grand cities. And through the course of the various sequels, we discover there was an ancient civilization there that was fairly high-tech in a steampunk kind of way.
Mm.
And that's revealed in some of the later books.
Will you do another one?
I'm doing other things related to Dinotopia. I don't know if I'll dive into another huge book because it's a big commitment of time. But all the books are brought back out again by Dover, which is a great publisher for keeping their backlist alive. And we've released anniversary editions with a lot of back matter about the making of and behind the scenes.
When you look at when a show like this opens in, as it will in Stamford, Connecticut, the audience is young and old then.
It is, and the book was really intended for all ages. That's one thing about publishing that always interested me, even since I was a kid, was that the picture books are often thought of as something for kids. But when I was a kid, I would ride my bicycle past the children's library in Palo Alto, California, where I grew up, and go to the adult library because I was more interested in adult books. And as a writer, I'm not really thinking about this particular age group, you know, for the book. And in the life of the book, I've run into librarians who told me that there's a real gap in the book field, the publishing field, for visual books for older readers. And I think the graphic novels have been a part of what's filled that gap. And my librarian tells me that that's the one area of publishing that's actually growing, of print publishing anyway.
My mother, who was a librarian, when I was a child, our library, the children's section was upstairs, the adult section was downstairs. And I said, well, you know, I don't know which section I should go into. And she said, you can't look at it as an adult section or a children's section. You have to look at it as a book section.
What a great mother. Because I know you grew up with a love of books. Did you have, in your own home, did you have books segregated as adult or children's books?
No, in my mother's library, you would find Dickens next to Charlotte's Web.
And did your parents read aloud to you?
Yes.
What books stuck in your mind that they read to you?
Everything. It was Uncle Wiggily. It was The Great Brain. It was, of course, E.B. White. Classics.
The great
classic,
to read aloud.
Classic
yeah.
books. Yeah, that those things. I think I've told the story on the air, but it was a whole production when I went to bed. It was my mother would read stories. My father would do a puppet show. My mother. It was a whole thing. It was a whole big production.
We did the same thing with our guys. They're now in their 20s, but we read aloud to them from when they were in utero practically until they were 13 and 15. And at that point, I mean, they were reading all the way along through those years, but it was a ritual for us too. And I would try to remember the voices I was doing from the night before. And they'd say, no, you got the voice wrong of Uncle Cratchit or whatever, you know, So I'd try to remember. Sometimes I'd fall asleep while I was reading.
Yes.
And then go into some kind of surreal mind state.
And one of the things that, and you just said this, and it struck me, is that of librarians saying that there isn't a lot of art books for adults. And I remember in reading of, even though I was of reading age and was reading my own things, that when my mother would read to me, she would often look at books without words, of children's book without words, like Peter Speer comes to mind, who did Rain.
Oh, yeah.
And a couple of other beautiful books.
Fox Went Out on a Chilly Night.
That's right. Yeah. And those books that had no words and allow us to sort of go through and write our own story to them, which I remember that being a really cool thing, too, of sort of responding to the art.
Yes. And there have been some great examples of wordless picture books. Sean Tan's Arrival is another recent classic. And there you're dealing with, you don't have to worry about what words you choose. I think there was that movement with Dr. Seuss and the Random House books to simplify the word count.
Right.
And I was aware of that as a kid. I was like, wait a minute, I like those long words. And I think that's one of the reasons kids love dinosaurs, is that they have these long Latin names and kids can master those and their parents usually can't.
So when you, switching gears a little bit, but not a lot, but when you do the DVDs of the latest being Watercolor in the Wild, and you've written very scholarly books on, I don't know if you take offense to that or not.
No.
I mean, they are scholarly, but they're also general interest. I mean, they're very much for people who are interested in the subject. But what I find fascinating is that you've also taken this as a mission of your work to explain what you do.
Yeah, I'm probably more of an explainer than a teacher.
Yes.
As far as the art instruction books go. This all grew out of the blog. I do a daily blog. I have for about 5 years
now. Which is great.
And more than 3,000 posts. And the reason I did that was to download a lot of what I had learned about painting that I had otherwise written in notebooks. And I discovered there was a whole group of people out there who came back with a lot of ideas that educated me. And I learned a lot from doing that. And as a writer, doing a book that was sort of, I thought of, I'll just do a compilation of these blog posts. I did the first book was Imaginative Realism, about how to do a realistic picture of an imaginary subject, followed by a book called Color and Light, which brings together the subject of color from a painter's point of view with the question of light and how that relates to color. And those were never really brought together in one book before, even though there were a lot of books on color theory. But I wanted to make it practical, and I went back to a lot of 19th century sources for ideas of how do you paint water or foliage or atmosphere, but also a lot of recent discoveries, breaking stuff on neuroscience about how we perceive color and also how our eyes move through a picture.
And that's what I found fascinating about that book, because as I do not paint, and I know if an artist were to look at that and could use it and be able to employ some of those ideas within their work of how helpful that must be. But for me, it was reading it and changing the way I look.
Yes, it changes the way you look at the world.
Yes.
To know, like, late in the day when the sun gets warmer, more orange, and the shadows appear bluer, why is that? Things like that.
And in photography as well.
In photography, yeah. And you become, as a painter, you become very aware of all these things. But also about how our eyes move through a picture. That always has interested me. And I'm working, actually, I did a residency at Texas A&M a few months ago. And they have an eye-tracking system and a lot of graduate students who are working in this area to understand how we look at pictures. Because in the field of art instruction, there's a lot of dogma and pseudoscience about thinking that the picture moves our eye through it, through the compositional design principles. In fact, we're attracted to faces and hands more than any other subject, regardless of where you put them in a picture. And I'm interested in questions like, how does the title of a picture affect the way you look at the picture? If you take the same picture and give it to a different group of people with five different titles, one of them, maybe sibling rivalry is one, or maybe the arrival of spring, will people look at the picture differently?
I guess that makes sense. Is that something when you see, if you go into a great art museum and you go and you see there's a picture of a child in a blue hat, and you look over and the name of the painting is A Child in a Blue Hat.
Or Untitled.
Yeah. Or Untitled. Yeah. And you think, all right, well, that makes sense. Then it doesn't have as much impact, I don't think, does it?
Well, I mean, there's so many ways of titling a painting, and you're right. And I think about the same thing. When I go into an art museum, I like to watch, do people look at the card first or the painting first?
Yes.
Do they need that card to kind of shape how they look at a picture? If all this is true, that means that the title of the picture is an element of composition, because it affects the way we look at the picture.
Does the size of the image matter? Do we look at it differently if we're looking at it in a book, or if we're looking at a scaled down size of an image compared to, you know, something in the Louvre that is room size?
That's a good question. The way that we've done tests of eye tracking is on a video monitor, a large video monitor that you sit a certain distance from. And the modern systems have infrared cameras that look at your eye position. So it's part of your visual field, I guess. But I don't know if it's an even bigger painting or a small painting. I'm not sure if that would affect it.
Because it is, but in other words, and you sort of answered the question, which is then it's ultimately the image that trumps all. It's what we're responding to, no matter what its size is in front of you. It is the image that we're responding
to. Right, and I think a lot of the eye tracking studies that have been done have been for graphic designers to look, and website designers. That's where the bulk of the work is done in this area, to see where people are looking on a screen, and do you look at banner ads that you don't click on, things like that. People want to know that, but just a pure image standing alone, that's a whole different question.
James Gurney is our guest, and he is the man behind the new DVD and download. It's Watercolor in the Wild. Also, his show, Dinotopia, The Fantastical Art of James Gurney, opens on Valentine's Day at the Stamford Museum and Nature Center in Stamford, Connecticut. When it comes to you as an artist, with that information of looking, learning and investigating color and light, learning and investigating where our eyes are going and the tracking of it, does that change you in any way as an artist? Does it make you more aware of where you're placing things?
I think in my case, I'm conscious and rational about all these principles, but then when it comes to painting from observation, they leave my mind, and hopefully it becomes intuitive. The other side of my art, besides the doing fantasy paintings or dinosaur paintings, is working from life and from observation, sitting outdoors and working in on street corners. Or we were just out at a farm the other day. It was way below freezing, and we were trying to figure out how to stay warm. My wife is also a painter. Working in water-based media in sub-freezing temperatures means that the paint freezes on the brush. And I was more worried about my fingers and toes, so I got those little Hunter's heating pads and put them in my gloves and all that. But the problem I had was that the paint was freezing. I mean, you can work in oil paint at much lower temperatures, but next time I'm going to bring vodka along and try painting with that, because that should freeze at a lower temperature. And if the painting doesn't come out, I'll just have a drink of the vodka.
That's right. You can have it along with you. I remember a few years ago you were here and you just painted this incredible picture of our. It was I remember a very dingy gray day, and you did this beautiful painting of our building, and with the possibility that I'm going to offend a great number of Albanians as well as the Chamber of Commerce, I will say that it is the most beautiful image of our fair city I have ever seen.
Well, thank you.
Meaning it took it through your eye to make what I see every day beautiful.
Well,
if that
dingy,
makes sense.
Dingy becomes beautiful in a painting, hopefully. And the only place I can find inspiration are at very well presented tourist destinations. I'd rather be on a well lived in corner and of an ordinary street. In fact, we just drove across America to visit our son in Colorado.
Yes.
And we stopped at Main Street America all the way across, just painting old signs and old buildings.
It seems that the lack of perfection interests you. I look at what you paint often, and if there is a telephone pole, and there is a part of the grass around the telephone pole that has not been weed whacked.
Yes,
that it is sprouting. That seems to interest you.
Yeah, because it shows the life that if it's architecture that has had, who's remodeled it, and they put on vinyl siding, and they've repainted it, and they put a sign, and it became a commercial space, and you can see that whole history of a building presented in its facade. And as you start to sketch it and kind of take it apart in your sketchbook, you have to really analyze what that history is. There's kind of an exciting revival of observational painting that's happened, I'd say, in the last 10 years or so, of plein air painting, which is basically going outdoors and painting in oil, usually from observation, and then urban sketching, which is more in sketchbooks, more pen and ink and watercolor. And both of these movements are very grassroots oriented, and they're part of, I think, a revival of interest in responding to our visual world.
In this latest DVD, you have Watercolor in the Wild. When we say that word wild, it's used very loosely, isn't it?
Yeah, wild meaning out of the studio.
Right.
I mean, but there's one painting I do in a graveyard. There's one that I do, there's one I do in a farmyard of a baby miniature horse. And the whole thing is done in real time, where I set up as the horse is taking a nap. And I knew it would take 15-minute nap or so. So I set up and did a sketch of it while it was sleeping.
It brings up an interesting point of when you are out in nature, of how much time you have to observe what it is that you want to observe. And I guess that varies, doesn't it?
It does, because the light is moving. The sun will move about the width of the palm of your hand, outreached palm of your hand, per hour. So if you're going to be there for 3 or 4 hours, the light could be very different. And that means usually most of my on-the-spot paintings are 2 or 3 hours max, or else I'll come back the next day at the same time of day. But yeah, there's all kinds of variables of light. The sun could go behind a cloud, and then people come up and ask questions, and that's either fun or disconcerting, depending on how crowded it is. But you really are taking your studio outdoors.
It is. Your work is incredible in that there is such a... yes, there's a fantastical world that you show, but I guess I get this from your blog posts of just seeing such a realistic sense and something that is I'm going to use a word, and I just want to see how you respond to it, and that is a comfort in it. And I'm interested in what you think there is about us that relates to okay, yes, something that we know, but also your take on it that gives us a sense of the familiar that is comforting.
Do you mean a comfort from your perspective as a viewer?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. It's hard for me to speak to that, to what your response would be. For me, it's the experience of sketching it is much more one of just encounter of something and discovery of something. And I'm feeling, usually when I'm painting, I'm uncomfortable in the sense that I'm not sure what I'm doing and I don't know if this is going to work, and hopefully it comes together.
So I guess it's my way was a clumsy way of asking, how much do you care about what we see?
Well, in my sketchbooks, I'm not too conscious of how what it's communicating to someone else. I'm more just exploring. I mean, my heroes for outdoor painting are people mostly from the 19th century, like William Trost Richards and John Singer Sargent and Albert Bierstadt, a lot of the Hudson River School painters who were really dedicated outdoor painters, not to do paintings to sell in galleries, but to do raw material that they would refer to when they did their paintings in the studio.
James Gurney is our guest. His exhibit, Dinotopia, The Fantastical Art of James Gurney, opens on Valentine's Day at the Stamford Museum and Nature Center in Stamford, Connecticut, and runs through May 25th. Also, his new art instruction video is Watercolor in the Wild. You can find out more about all of it by going to his website, jamesgurney.com, jamesgurney.com. That's G-U-R-N-E-Y, jamesgurney.com. James, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the
program. My pleasure, Joe, and good luck with the fun drive.
Thank you, and thank you for the donation. We'll be talking about your work during it, so I look forward to it.
All right.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.